This week, let's try to get back to the deeper issues. See if we can work out together a subject deep in Torah thinking that is a challenge to perception, to thought, to the definition of the spiritual path altogether. Not an easy subject. Let's try and put our minds into it. The question is this. You're going to have to concentrate together because we hope here to look at some of the deepest areas, things that the most explicitly brought to expression in the Kabbalistic sources. Not easy ideas. The problem is this. The problem is that the Torah makes it clear, and the Rambam, who is bringing down this particular area of Torah thinking definitively as halachic obligation, makes it absolutely clear that when thinking about that which is above, thinking about that which transcends the physical world, one is not allowed to picture anything that is tangible. Right? In other words, to put it in plain language, thinking about God or Hashem, you may not picture anything that is tangible. The way the Rambam puts it is, you have to know that that which is in the higher, that which transcends our ability to know directly, there's a specific prohibition of giving it any tangible form, any corporeal or physical or tangible representation. The way the Rambam puts it actually is fascinating. He says that it's one of the 13 axioms or the 13 principles of Jewish belief, or the way he phrases it over there, is that if you are transgressing one of these 13 things, you have no share in the world to come at all. And that is that a person who believes that the source of creation, that the focus of what Torah and Judaism is all about, if you believe that he has any, the way the Rambam puts it is, guf ubal tmuna, that means that he has a body or any concept that can be diagrammed, right, has a picture or an image. What he means is that it's not only atheistic, or whatever the correct English word is, to believe that at that level there is a physical body. It's also just as forbidden to believe that up there there is some sort of diagrammatic form. Doesn't matter whether you believe that he has a physical body, inhabits a physical body, or you believe that some sort of Kabbalistic diagram or some sort of whatever it is, it makes no difference. If it's anything that can be pictured, if it's anything that can be represented, then it's not what we believe. And it's one of the most serious prohibitions in the Torah. It's connected to idolatry, for which a person has to die. A very, very serious prohibition. Technically, it's known as Hakshama. Hakshama means giving Hashem a body, giving him some sort of tangible or physical representation. There are certain religions which do that. Such religions, you're forbidden to step into their places of worship. And therefore, it's completely forbidden to picture anything that can be tangibly represented. Right? In its most blatant form, somebody who says that Hashem has parts of a body, he has a hand or a foot or an eye. If you say that, then you're transgressing this prohibition. It's absolutely fundamental. It's a breach and a breakdown of the most basic Torah understanding. It's not what Judaism is. It's akin to idolatry, etc. So far, so good? Anyone out there? The obvious problem is, and I'm sure your minds are moving ahead of me, the obvious problem is that the Torah talks about God as if he has a hand and a foot and an eye and an arm and a beard and payas and hair and you name it. The Torah is full of descriptions of Hashem, of God having parts. The Torah describes him in exactly the terms that the Rambam says you're forbidden to think in. with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and it says, Eine Hashem, Hashem's eyes are shooting across the world at all times. It says that his feet stand in this place and his feet stand in that place. There are places that talk about his beard and his place. The Torah talks about that all the time. So we have a fundamental problem. Now let's put our minds into this. We have a fundamental problem. On the one hand, you are forbidden. Right? You're forbidden to think that he has a hand. Not only are you forbidden, but it's wrong. It's silly and it's wrong. And it's forbidden. And yet the Torah does it. The problem is twofold. First of all, you know that the Torah obeys its own rules. I don't know if you're familiar with that principle. We have a principle that God obeys his own rules. Not only that, the sources are absolutely clear that he keeps his own mitzvahs. You know that? The Gemara says that, for example, he wears tefillin. He wears tefillin. Hashem wears tefillin. What's written in his tefillin? Praise of us, just like our tefillin have praise of him. Our tefillin have psukim that say that he is one God, and his tefillin have psukim praising the Jewish people for being one unitary and unique nation on earth. He wears tefillin. Believe it or not, the Talmud says that he prays. It's like we have an obligation to daven, prayer. He does that. To whom? To whom? And what does he ask for? It's a subject. Has to be discussed. It's a deep subject. But he obeys his own commandments. He obeys his own commandments. So, if he obeys his own commandments, then why, when he writes his Torah, in which he communicates to us what we need to know, does he break the prohibition? Does he transgress the prohibition of describing himself in terms that we know? What's going on? What is going on? It's an explicit commandment of the Torah that you may not think. It's one of the 13 basic principles of Judaism, that you may not picture him as having a hand. And he writes his Torah talking about my hand. Why? It's ridiculous, it's wrong, and it's forbidden. So why does he do it? Fundamental issue. Let's try and study it. First of all, you realize here we're not talking about the problem. There are a number of problems here. One is, I want to be sure to cover the practicalities. There's a practical side of the subject as well. It isn't only mystical knowledge. There's a practical side. The practical side is, when you say words that indicate this reality, what are you supposed to see with your eyes? You know, when you make a bracha, right? You make a blessing. You're praying, for example. You make a blessing. Talking to Hashem. Say, Baruch Atah, and then you say his name. What are you supposed to see when you say that name? You make a blessing, you're saying his name, you're speaking to him. What are you supposed to picture when you say his name? You may not picture anything. If you picture, let's make it absolutely ridiculous, huh? A man in the sky with a white beard. That nobody in their wildest imagination would ever. The truth is, if you're brought up in Western culture, that's what you see even when you try not to. Exactly, especially when you try not to, that's what you see. And if you say you don't, you lie. That's the result of being brought up in the background, in the culture that we were brought up in. But let's say you're more elevated than that. That's not your problem. You don't see that. You see something else. But you may not see anything. We're not asking here what you mean when you say his name. That's clear. That's not difficult. That's not difficult. It's written in the code of Jewish law, in the Shulchan Aruch. When you say Hashem's name, what you should mean. It's clear. The name Yudke Vavke, right? The name that we never pronounce, right? Yudke Vavke, the name that the Jay's witnesses, right? They purport to pronounce that name. We don't do that. We never say that name. That name has a meaning. When you refer to that name, when you make a bracha, that's the name you mean. We don't pronounce it. We say another word. We say Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, right? Shem Adnus Adoy. That name. Are we all together? We say that name, but we don't mean that name. We mean the name that you cannot say. In your mind, you mean the real name, the name of what he is, and with your mouth, you say the name that sources say is the name that brings his presence down into the world. It's a different kind of a name. This is not the time to get into the differences. That's the word that you say. What do the words mean? So the word, Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud, that word, Adoy, that you're saying, that means that he's a master of the world and that his presence manifests in the world. The Shem Elokim means that he's the master of all the energies and all the forces of nature. What does the name Yudke Vavke mean? That name itself, it means was, is, and shall be. It means existence. It's all tenses, if you like. It's a mixed It's a word that indicates the combination of all Hebrew tenses of the word that indicates existence. It means it is total existence that transcends time. He exists, but he's the source of existence. He is the existence of existence. That's what the word means. But what do you see with your eyes when you say it? That's the question. Not what do you mean. What you mean is absolutely clear. Hashem Elokim means Ba'ala Kechas Kulam. He is the master of all energies in the universe. Fine, that's what it means. What do you see when you say it? That's the problem. You know, we are graphic creatures. We have a tendency, we see things with our eyes. Right? We see things. Even when you close your eyes, that's when you really see things. So what are you supposed to see when you say the name? That's the question.
You're supposed to feel it.
So that's our problem. That's our problem. That's our problem. So the commentaries who talk about this say that there are only three things that are allowed to be pictured. Now stay with me carefully. There are three options. There are three options that you may picture. One, option one, nothing at all. Nothing at all? Nothing at all. The Reb Chaim Volozhin says that his Rebbe, the Gaon of Vilna, used to daven that way. When he said Hashem's name, it was Katinoika Mischata Lifnei Aviv, like a baby saying Abba. Saying Abba, without knowing, without any picture. It means Father, Abba. Calling out without any graphic picture at all. That's fine. That's fine. You're allowed to do that. Some people find it impossible. Many people find it impossible, especially when you try. Especially when you try to see nothing. Right? Especially when you try. You know that thought control, this is a separate subject, but thought control is probably the most difficult area of self-control. Right? Actions are much easier to control because you can stop the action. Even if you have a tremendous urge, you can stop the action. But to stop a thought requires enormous, enormous self-discipline. In fact, at the lower stages of self-development, it's probably impossible. It's probably impossible. In fact, almost a guaranteed way to think what you don't want is to try not to think about it. That usually happens. It usually happens when you're davening Shemoneh Esrei. That's when it usually happens. And especially when you say to yourself, this time you're going to do really well. This time you're going to focus on every word and you're really going to speak to him and you're going to think about it. It usually happens is you find yourself taking three steps back and you've been in Hong Kong or worse. I don't know where you've been. And it's especially when you challenge yourself by telling yourself that you'll have complete purity of thought. That is when... That's when the worst thoughts are... That's the norm. That's the norm. So when you tell yourself that you're not going to think a certain thing, that's when it pounces, and that's when that's all you can think about. But it's even worse when you tell yourself you're going to think about nothing. When you tell yourself you're not going to think about a certain thing, and you think about something else, so you choose something else that has power, so you think about it. Hold your interest for a few moments. But when you tell yourself you're going to think of nothing, it means you're going to completely clear the screen. It's almost a superhuman challenge. Almost a superhuman challenge. So for those who can manage it, you can think nothing. That's allowed. What about those who cannot think that? See that? So there are two other options. One is called the kavanos. Kavanos are the mystical area of permutations of certain divine names. It's a skill that largely been lost now. It was the province of the deep Kabbalistic thinkers and masters. It's a great, a tremendously elevated skill, takes tremendous self-discipline. People with a Sephardi background, for example, the Sephardi custom in these areas, many people who learn the Kabbalistic wisdom, especially from a Sephardi angle, they learn usually the Siddur of the Rashash. If you've ever looked at that book, it's one of the great Kabbalistic commentaries. It takes the form of a Siddur. And when you get there, if you look up, for example, the Shemoneh Esrei, right, the central part of the prayer service, the first page has only one word. You should look at it sometimes, fascinating to see. The first page has only one word, the word Baruch. The word Baruch, that's all, the first word of Shemoneh Esrei. And around it are all the combinations and permutations of the divine names that word implies that you should be going through while you see the word. In fact, if you've ever been to Yerushalayim, one or two places where they daven like that, where they pray like that, the prayer service is very interesting. When the chazan, the Shliach Tzibur, starts going through the repetition of the Shemoneh Esrei, he says only one word. He starts up, he says the word Baruch, and then there's a pause for about 5 minutes while everybody works through all the permutations. It takes a long time to get through Shemoneh Esrei that way. And a tremendous concentration. Avshal Dweck, one of the great Mechabnim of the last generation, into concentration used to be so intense that when he was leading the service, when he used to get to the Sefer Zena Einenu, he used to pass out. He used to pass out. He used to wait for him to come around. It was a tremendous effort. Tremendous effort. Most modern authorities say that it's not allowed for us now. This is not allowed for us. We don't have the ability to concentrate. It's bad enough. Most of us can't even hold our train of thought even when we're going rapidly and smoothly, let alone when you've got time to wander off. Some say that the skill of davening very fast was, some people developed that specifically to keep their mind on track, even very great people. They say about Reb Chaim himself that when everybody used to pray together, he used to be finished so fast it was impossible to keep up. He was, you know, he'd be finished so fast. So one day somebody had the temerity to walk up to him, and they said to him, "We just came to ask the Rosh Hashiva, maybe he wouldn't mind that since you get through your filler so quickly, we don't have time. Perhaps when you get through it, you could just stand where you are for a little while longer, thinking and learning, to give us time." He said, "Yes, I'm doing that already." So for most of us, to give yourself enough time to sort of really concentrate, unfortunately, for most of us, it doesn't turn out to be concentration. It turns out to be taking a world tour. And it's much better to go fast and smooth. So that's the second issue. And again, people who talk about it in this generation say that you shouldn't even attempt that. What's the third option? The third option that you can see with your eyes, and fortunately for most of us, it's a wonderful option, is there is one graphic image that you're allowed to see. There's one graphic thing that you can see. You can't picture any Kabbalistic diagrams, and you can't see a man in the sky with a white beard, and none of that. But there's one thing you can see. There's one black on white, tangible graphic image that you're allowed to see, and that is his name. The name. You're allowed to see a yud, and a hey, and a vav, and a hey. That you're allowed to picture. It contradicts the infinity and the problem of not being able to represent what he is in graphic form. Yes, it does, but it's been given to us. It is a tremendous mystery that which denotes complete indivisible oneness can be represented by a name that has four letters or five letters, if you understand the Kabbalistic beginning of the first letter. But it's been given to us. And therefore, you are allowed to picture that name. In fact, the halacha is that when you pray, when you daven, you either have to have your eyes closed. There are only two options. You may not look around when you daven. You're not allowed to look around. You either have to have your eyes closed and daven from memory, or you must look in the siddur. You must be looking in the siddur that you're reading the words from. And that's why many people are fussy to use a siddur that prints the name out correctly. But there are many siddurim, unfortunately, that do not print the name correctly. When they come to Hashem's name, in order not to be guilty of writing a name that may be erased, they write it by denoting it with a little sign. They have either a dalet with a dash, or a hey with a dash, or two yuds, or something like that. That's totally impossible. Because when you're looking at those words, you now have to remember that with your mind you must think yud ke vav ke, the meaning. With your mouth you must say adnus and the meaning of that. With your mind's eye you must picture yud ke vav ke, while your physical eyes are looking at something else. If that doesn't cause you to become schizoid instantly, then nothing will. And therefore, it's advisable, if you're working on this seriously, to use a siddur in which the name is printed correctly. Even a modern art scroll siddur, for example, landed it without vowels, of course, so you shouldn't accidentally be induced to actually pronounce it. But nevertheless, the consonants are written out correctly. So all Svardi siddurim, basically, if you look in a Svardi siddur, you'll see they print out the name. Very often they print out the name Yud Kei Vav Kei, and in the last hey, they print out Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, so you can see what you're supposed to say while your eyes. Or they do what's called a shiluv. They print the four letters of Yud Kei Vav Kei interspersed with the four letters of Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. So you see how the one name manifests the other name, right? Those are graphic devices to teach how the one gives. They're all Kabbalistic ideas that have tremendously deep meaning. But that is what it is. And we're not talking about this evening. I'm not asking you. We're not asking here. Right? That's not our subject. Our subject is why. Are we together so far? That's an aside, right? What do you see with your mind's eye when you do this, since you may not see anything? Right? You may not see anything. You can't see a hand and an eye and a foot. Of course not. He doesn't have a hand and a foot and an eye. It would seem. But you can see the name Yud Kei Vav Kei. He gave that in the Torah, and that's the Jews allowed to see that and picture it. It's a name that may not be erased. It has intrinsic sanctity, even though it's graphic. That's another subject. Let's get back to our main subject. Why does the Torah say that he has a hand if he doesn't have a hand? Please stay with me. It's a fantastic subject to understand. I guarantee that if you understand the subject correctly, you'll never be the same again. Like how religious or irreligious you are. I mean, I care if you're religious, obviously, but... Are we clear about the problem? Only one person in the room? Do we share the problem? The Torah says you may not conceive of him as having any parts of a body. And the Torah speaks about parts of his body. Okay, that's the problem. Let's deal with the answer to this problem. The Rambam deals with this problem. The Rambam phrases this in his classic work, at the beginning of his classic work, where he discusses the fundamentals of Jewish belief. And the Jew, it doesn't just belief, the obligation of a Jew to believe and to know. He says that any time the Torah, listen carefully, any time the Torah talks about anything that seems to be graphic, like Hashem's parts of his body, or functions, when it talks about him being tired or being angry or anything like that, or even when it talks about, says the Rambam, and he uses the following classic phrase: Dibrat Torah kaloshon bnei Adam. Dibrat Torah kaloshon bnei Adam. The Torah speaks in human words. Stay carefully with me. The Torah speaks the way people speak. It speaks in human language. In English, you would say it uses metaphorical, it uses borrowed language. Right? It doesn't say what it is. It says words we can understand. Right? The common English expression would be an analogy. What you call a mashal. Gives a mashal. Gives an analogy. A metaphor analogy. You, after all, can't understand things in that world. So it gives you analogous words in your world. Right? Are we together? It uses words you can understand. After all, how are you going to communicate with somebody if they only understand? If you're trying to communicate something to someone who doesn't know what you mean. And when you say the right word, it will mean totally, absolutely nothing to them. So what's the use of saying the right word? Rather say a word that they understand, from which they can infer or imply or begin to learn about what you mean. That's what an analogy is, isn't it? Isn't it? If I want to teach you about something and I can't show it to you, it's beyond your vision, it's in the next room, you can't see it. And it's complicated. So I build an analogy. I build something in this room that you can see. It's not the thing itself, but it's an exact parallel. And we study this thing and talk about it, and from this you can begin to understand what that you cannot see, what it must be. The Torah, since it can't say what he really is, because if it did, you wouldn't know what it's talking about. Therefore, it says things that you can understand. And from that you can extrapolate, and you can deduce, and you can infer, and you can begin to transfer and translate your knowledge into what it really is. Right? That's what he says. Dibrateri Koloshin Ben Adam. The Torah speaks in human words. The problem is, yeah, hear this well, that doesn't help. What is he saying? That doesn't help. Again, we're dealing with deep and subtle issues. Let's take the steps together. What kind of solution is that? We talk about the Rambam here, one of the greatest thinkers in Jewish history, talking about enormous intellect, enormous Torah intellect. What does he mean the Torah speaks in human terms? That doesn't help. If the Torah says something about Hashem using borrowed language, he doesn't really have a hand. He doesn't really have a hand. The Torah says he has a hand because we couldn't understand what he really does have. It's forbidden. It's forbidden. And it's wrong. Again, what's he telling us? Well, you can't really understand what it is, so I'm going to use these words. But it's a Torah prohibition to do that. Are you with me? It's a prohibition to think about him as having a hand. I can't understand what it really is, so you can do that which is prohibited. Ah, it's wrong. You can do that which is wrong. The Torah has to be true in every single possible way. Every nuance, every movement, every subtlety, every inflection of everything in the Torah has to be absolutely true. How can you say something that's not true? What's the justification? Well, the person I'm speaking to cannot understand truth. So you can say lies? What is going on? Let me try to make this clear. That's the best way to illustrate it is like this. If I build an analogy, yes, I want you to understand something that you cannot see. So I make an analogy to that thing. Analogies aren't true. Analogy is not true. Analogy is not the thing itself. Is this clear? An analogy, a mashal, is not the thing itself. It may be brilliant. It may be highly effective. It may be genius. It may do the job. But it's not the thing itself. If I'm talking about something here, so that you understand about something there, that's, no one's complaining. It's wonderful. But it's not the thing over there. The Torah always talks about the thing itself. The Torah doesn't talk about borrowed things from which you can understand about real things. The Torah is the definition of truth. It is exactly what it says. It must be. That's the nature of Torah. That's what it is. Analogies are not true. The Torah is not an analogy to something that's true. The Torah is the thing itself. That's axiomatic in Torah. So how can the Torah come along? Yeah, that's true, but this person cannot understand the real word. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to build something that's really not true. And it's also forbidden. Because, is that what's going on? Torah condescends to the world of lies, and it condescends to the world of that which is forbidden. Well, what's going on? Especially here, we're talking about the highest things. What does he mean? What does he mean when he says the Torah uses human language? How are we going to get out of this problem? Do we share the problem so far? It's going to be a long night. So let's move ahead. One solution that's been suggested, not suggested, one correct solution, but I'd like to show you that it's not adequate for us. We have to see beyond it as well. One solution is that, stay carefully with me, when the Torah talks about any attribute of Hashem, whether it's a function or whether it's a part, like a hand or an eye, it's not talking about Him. It's talking about what He does. It's not talking about Him, where He is, as it were. It's talking about what He does in the world. The name that's given to that in the sources that talk about it is called Hanhogas. Hanhogas means the way that he interacts or conducts affairs of the world. For example, when it talks about Hashem's hand, it means what He does here. After all, this is a finite and tangible reality, and He operates within it. So it's fair enough to talk about His operation within the world. You can talk about that in a particular differentiated sense. You can say when an event happens over here, He's done that event. So if you want to say that He's done something and you use the word His hand, that's the appropriate way to express that thing. If you want to indicate the fact that He knows what's doing, you talk about His eyes. After all, it means a function of perceiving or seeing. So you talk about His eyes. You talk about a mighty hand, an outstretched arm. You're talking about the fact that He is functioning and acting within the tangible, differentiated, finite world. And therefore, these are hanhagot. These are hanhogas. They are methods of interaction with the world, and that's why the Torah uses these words. That has been not suggested. That's true. What's the problem? What's the problem with this? One obvious problem. Are you with me? One obvious problem is, if every word that it uses to describe a part of His body is the fact that He's doing something in the world, what's His beard doing? What's this doing in the world? What are His payas doing in the world? What is His hair and His curls and His ringlets and His locks and what are those doing in the world? Parts of the face, forehead talks about. What are they doing? How are you going to explain those parts? The truth is, the Kabbalistic wisdom does give an answer to that. And it's very, very much too difficult to go into now, but it does talk about the functions, as it were, although they're transcendent and marvelous things. It does talk about the functions of those areas. But can you see that it does not solve our problem? Because if the Torah, listen carefully, please, if the Torah says that Hashem has a certain part or aspect or function, it's not good enough saying that it means He operates here. If the Torah says He has it, it must be true. Can you feel this? To say that what it really means is He interacts with me as if down here it manifests as a sort of a hand, that's fine, but the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says that He has a hand. It says He has an eye. It says that. The Torah must be, it must be true. It's got to be 100.00, it's got to be absolutely true. It's not. Can you see that when you talk about a hand meaning what He does, it's also sort of an analogy. Can you see this? So we're in trouble. We're in trouble. Okay, let's try and express the answer. It's not easy to find the words for, but here's the, everything turns on this point, so let's try and build it carefully. The Torah is absolutely true. If it says He has a hand, He has a hand. It means exactly what it says. It's exactly the definition of truth. If it says He has an eye and He has a hand, He has a hand. The solution is this. In your mind, you think that this is a hand. You think this is a hand, and His hand is an analogy. That's what you think. His hand is a hand. This is an analogy. Stay with me. When the Torah talks about Hashem's hand, it's telling it like it is. It means exactly what it says. Can you begin to understand what that is? Not at all. That's why you have this. You are the analogy. We are the marshal. We're the analogy. When the Torah only says things the way it is, but it speaks in human language. It uses words that say exactly what they mean, but they're words that you can relate to in your illusory world. You and me, we're the analogy. We're in a world of illusion compared to the world of reality. The Torah uses words that are pitched in the source,
where you couldn't begin to relate to them. But it uses the same words that the analogy is built off, so you can... And why? Because he wants you to understand him. But you can't understand him. He's indivisible oneness. If you would be there, you wouldn't be there. If you would be there, you wouldn't be you. It would all be one. So you can't begin to understand that. But he wants you to, because that's where you're going. So he puts you in a world of analogies. You understand? Where what his hand is, although it's off limits to your human understanding, but he gives you this thing. And if you get to understand what this is very, very well, you begin to be able to project what it must be. For example, again, the whole world's built this way. The whole world's built this way. What's the point of human relationships? What's the point of a relationship when you get married or you have a deep friendship? It's to get to know the person. But you never see the person, you only see their body. You never see a person. You can't see a person, you don't have an organ. You don't have a sense or a faculty or a sense organ that ever sees another person. You can't feel or see or smell or taste another person. You can only relate to their body. But it's good enough. Because if you watch their body carefully, you get to know who they are. How do you ever get to know a person? By watching their body. The only possibility you have. You watch the movements of the body. You watch the movements of every part of the body. You watch the nuances of change of expression. You listen to the words, which are physical things. The person speaks to you. Right? The words are much more explicit. They're much more articulate. They're much more sensitive. Right? Expressions of what the person's internality is than movements of the body. But the movements of the body can be very expressive. At a critical moment in a relationship, when you say something and you watch the person's face and you see a slight change of expression, but it's enough to tell you that they understood exactly what you meant, and from that moment on your relationship's different forever. What happened was a few muscles twitched. That's what happened. A few muscles twitched, no different than a monkey's face. But it speaks worlds of what's going on inside, and it's good enough. It's good enough. The whole world of meaning we only relate to through the vehicle of externality. We only get to the spiritual source by engaging the physical vehicle. It's a remarkable thing. We only affect the spiritual source that way. That's what a mitzvah is. It's a physical action that sends a force up into the spiritual world. And we only know about and learn about the spiritual world by engaging the physical. You want to know what a person is, and you want to know who this person is? Watch their body. It's all you have. Watch it carefully. It's all you have. Of course, the message is you should be watching the world that way. You should watch a tree that way, too. You should watch a tree that way. You should know what moves inside the clothing of a tree, and what moves inside the skin, what ripples beneath the skin of the entire physical structure. You can learn what ripples beneath the skin by seeing the physical structure. It's the only avenue of access you have. So, the concept's like this. Let's talk just for a few moments in the world of the Kabbalistic ideas, although by definition there aren't any words. Why can't you understand what his hand is? Because by definition there's no difference between his hand and his foot, or his eye. Since he's one, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, right? Hashem is one. So what does it mean that he's one, which all one indivisible oneness, and he's got a hand and he's got an eye? You can't understand that. By definition, can't understand it down here. Good, you're right. Just like you can't see a human soul and know what it is, it's much too high and much too big for you, right. Give you a body. Look at this person's body, even though it's ridiculous absurdity compared to their soul, but it's good enough. Once you watch their body accurately and carefully, women do this better than men. Women are better, even in this battered and perverted generation. Women are still better at looking at a body and reading what's inside. Men are, especially in the West and especially in this generation, very problematic in this area. That's what the commentaries say. A woman can look at a man's physical reality or person, she can see what's inside. She can listen to words and know what's being meant. If you really want to understand people, you have to listen to what they say. You have to listen to what they're not saying, if you really want to understand what they mean. You have to listen between the lines and inside the words. You have to listen to the voice and not the words. Women have a talent for being able to do that. Many Torah sources for that. Especially in relationships and in a marriage and knowledge of her children. But it's through the structure of physicality that she can perceive what's inside. And a man who trains himself becomes sensitive. That's what we're trying to do. The effort of growing spiritually is to be able to look at the physical world and know what the spiritual source is. And that's the nature of the physical world. Now, let's take it one step further. The concept we have, and I think we've discussed this before in other contexts, is that the physical world is the projection of a spiritual world. The body looks the way it does because the soul, the neshama, is projected into physical tissue in the shape that the body has. That's a deep Kabbalistic principle. If you like, a modern analogy, the sources give other analogies, but translated into a modern analogy, we have to use analogies for this subject, right? Because we're dealing within the marshal. We're dealing within the analogy. The analogy would be, if you have a light shone through a film, and the film projects itself onto a screen. We've discussed this analogy before. Then whatever's on the screen, you will find on the film. And whatever's on the film, you'll find on the screen. Now, in the spiritual world, something's being projected, and exactly the way it is projected is exactly the way it arrives in the physical world. And you can study one from the other. That's a basic principle, a basic axiom. In some descriptions, the light is the emanation of divine energy from the source, the film is the Torah, and the projection on the screen is the world. Every word in the Torah projects itself into the world as the object that that word describes or creates. Now let's take this further, right? Can you see that if this is true, it means that every object in the world teaches you something about the spiritual source? In fact, one of the definitions of every detail in the world is that it's an analogy to teach you about the source. You know what a wonderful way of looking at the world that is? When you take an apple, or you take a human experience, joy, the happiness of a marital relationship, let's say, marriage, or friendship, tears, crying, laughter, any human experience or phenomenon or emotion, you know what you're learning? You're learning something about a spiritual source that is exactly parallel to this thing. This thing is the way it does. You laugh and you cry in the world. You built that way. Those are universal human responses to certain situations, because in the spiritual world, there's a reality that looks that way. And you can learn all about it by just watching your own body and watching your own psychological makeup. Again, every aspect of your body, no matter how lowly, is teaching you about something that is so high that you can't begin to relate to it directly. But don't worry about that. Look at this. Look at the object. Look at the organ or the function or the faculty. Every psychological experience that you go through, every emotional experience, is something that is exactly parallel to its source in the spiritual world, and it comes to teach you about that thing. And that's what it's here for. And the whole world is like that. There's nothing that he expects you to relate to that he doesn't give you an example of. And there's nothing that he gives you that isn't here to teach you about its source. Let's take a few examples. Let's make it practical. Laughter. We spoke about laughter a week before last, I think. What did we say laughter is? Who is not here? Without going into the details. Laughter is an incredible thing, right? We studied it at length. Laughter is the response, ridiculous response, no sense. When one thing suddenly changes into its opposite unexpectedly and sharply, it makes you laugh. Something very dignified and conceited suddenly slips on a banana peel and laid out flat. Nothing funny about that. Yeah, emotional problem if you laugh at such a thing. But it's funny. And we developed this and studied it. What does it teach you? Teaches you about the transition from this world to the next world. Nothing less than that. This ridiculous and superficial human expression teaches you about dying, which is the most incredible and extreme reversal of situations, where a thing goes in one direction and looks like it's going one place, and dying and disintegrating, and that's the real birth. That is really funny. In certain Eastern religions, I'm not going into details now, they talk about the laughing man. Talk about the laughing man. Again, without going into it. But that's universal spiritual wisdom, that this human phenomenon of laughter that animals don't do, you know what it teaches you? You know what crying is? You know what crying teaches you? What is crying, for pity's sake? Something happens, something goes wrong. What does this mean? So if you look in the textbooks, they probably tell you that, I don't know, a few million years ago when you were a gorilla, certain psychological tensions built up, and unless you cried, you died probably. I don't know what they tell you. But you need your head right if you think that way. You know what crying is? Crying is the physiological response to a situation where a road ends. You know that? Where a road ends, where a direction becomes unclear. You don't cry when you have a difficult road to follow. That's not when you cry. That's when you grunt and groan and strain with effort. You cry when you have no road to follow. When you come to a place where you thought the road led and it doesn't lead there anymore. And there's many roads and you're confused. That's when you know the Hebrew word bechi. I mean, it's wonderful to understand this. The Hebrew word bechi, which means crying, You know, we've discussed the fact before that in Hebrew, every word means what it says. In Hebrew, bechi means crying. The same root in Hebrew is, you know what, mevuchai, and mevucha in Hebrew is a maze. You know, a place where you can't find the road, where all the roads get confused? That's called mevucha. Do you know what that means? That means in the emotions, in the inner world, when the mind and the psyche gets to a place where the roads are confused, right, when there's a maze and you don't know where to go, that brings the neshama to that which is called crying. It's the same thing. That there's no clarity here. There's a dissolution. The Maharal says that's why you cry water. Why does water come out of your eyes when you cry? You see, you've been doing this ever since you were... That's why you're not sensitized to it. But if you came from Mars and you saw a human being going to a certain point in life where the road seemed to end and they suddenly started and water started coming out of their eyes... If you had any sense, you'd ask, what does this mean? Because the vision, the organ in your body that sees direction, that sets goals and sees directions plainly, when there's no goal to be seen, the means, the medium of dissolution, the Maharal says that water is always the medium of dissolving, where a thing loses its identity. Water dissolves things, and water makes things part of it. That's what drowning is. So the part of the body, the highest sense that sees direction, dissolves in complete dissolution into formlessness. That's what. How was the world created? Cast your mind back. Didn't it solidify and crystallize out of water? Do you know what mikveh is? Do you know what happens when you go into the mikveh? What does it mean you go into a mikveh? You go into water, original water. It has to be pure water. It has to be water that's natural water, not piped or ducted. It has to be water that's only rainwater or completely natural. Why? Because water is the medium out of which the world was created. It was dissolved in complete lack of any form, and out of that crystallized a differentiated world. When you go to the mikveh, you're taking yourself back to a formless point of origin. The Shlomo says that when you go to mikveh, not when you go to the mikveh, when should be the moment of intention for purity? Most people think it's when you go under the water. It's when you come out of the water. When you go under the water is a dissolution into formlessness. It's when you emerge from the water, it's like the world being recreated. That's what it is. Crying is a movement into dissolution. You can feel that. Again, the words are very clumsy. And of course, when you cry, you can't speak. Speech is a form. Yeah? When you speak, you're putting sounds together that are the forming of a pathway that's meaningful. When you cry, you can't do that. You've reached a point of dissolution where it's all a maze. Crying, you know what it teaches you? Every emotion teaches you about something in the root. People get homesick. Homesickness. People get homesick. You know that? When they're away from home, they long for home. The Gemara says, Chayna makom al yoshva. The beauty of a place is upon those who live there. The Gemara talks about people who came from some place where there was only dust. Nothing at all, only dust. But when they were someplace else, they longed for their home. Nothing to long for, just dust. The place, especially a place of your youth, especially a place where you grew up, there's a certain attachment to the place. Remarkable thing, why? Why is that? So if you were brought up in Western culture, you think it's because when you were a pigeon, you had to find your way home. So after a few million years of being a pigeon, now you happen to be a whatever it is, you still have this. But we don't read the world that way. That's not the Torah way of looking at the world. We look at the world for its inner meaning. You know why you long for home? Because your neshama comes from a world, your soul comes from a world that is really your home, where you really did grow up, that's where you really were born, and it's a world of infinite ecstasy and oneness where you were part of Hashem's oneness. Do you know what a longing your neshama has for that? Do you know what a longing your neshama has? Your soul longs with all its might to be back there. You know, the Midrashim, the Chofetz Chaim brings it, Midrashim say that when the soul gets born, it's an enormous ordeal. When a person gets born, the soul refuses. It refuses to go down to the world. It doesn't want to be put in a human body. A human body is smelly. It contains excrement. It's the opposite of spirituality. Complete opposite. It's living in a world of infinite ecstasy, part of Hashem's oneness. And Hashem suggests putting it in a human body, full of earthy drives and lusts and the Chofetz Chaim says that all of your life is a tension between your soul that's trying to get out of your body and go back where it belongs, and your body trying to make it happy. They're complete opposites. Putting them together is called tele. It's called, the Hebrew word for that is, is the combination of impossible opposites. That's what your soul and your body is. The Chofetz Chaim says it's like, he gives an analogy, a beautiful analogy. He talks about a princess who come brought up in a palace of tremendous luxury and refinement, and by some strange sequence of events, she ends up marrying a peasant. She ends up marrying a peasant who lives on the land. And this individual is completely earthy and heavy. He's got no refinement at all. So when she comes to live in his hut on the land, and he clumps in with his big heavy boots, and she's longing for the refinement and the elegance of the palace and the courtesans and the music, but he sees she's unhappy. This earthy character sees she's unhappy. So he tries to make her happy. How does he try to make her happy? With what he knows. He brings her a very thick, smelly salami. But your body doesn't understand that. So your body tries to make her happy by giving it the things that makes it happy. But she's nauseated by that. Sometimes she's satiated for a while, and then she's always longing, and he can never make her happy. She's longing to go home. That's why you get homesick. You get homesick because your neshama is longing for the place it belongs. But you live in the psychological realm, you live in the physical, psychophysical realm, where you interpret that in terms of what you're familiar with. So you think, the way it manifests is that when you're away from home, you long to be back home. But the reason you have that psychological feature, why should that be? If you should have come from a place that's full of dust, and you live in Palm Springs, I don't know, some place that's nice, you should have been thrilled to be there. Why is it that you sit there in this luxury and you're dreaming about home? What sense does that make? Because your neshama is longing always to go where it comes from. And you can learn that from your emotions. People love to travel, you know that? It's a paradox. When people are away, they long to be home. But when they're home, they long to be traveling. You know, this world trip, fantastic trip, person comes home. 2 weeks later, started wondering what's someplace else that he hasn't been. Why do people want to travel? You know why? Because the neshama wants to move through the world and see all its wonder and beauty. Tremendous, incredible richness that the world has. Everything you can learn from. And people know that. They don't know that it's the neshama wanting to move through the world of Torah and mitzvahs and the real sights that are to be seen. So the psyche interprets it as wanting to travel. You think it means going to China, wherever it is. When you go there, you don't even look. You're so busy taking pictures to prove that you were there that you aren't even looking. To have been there. People long to buy things. You know that? People long to acquire and own and buy. People like to even think about buying things. You know that? People like to even go looking at the things they would buy if they could, even though they're not going to. Men and women are a little different here as well, but that's another subject. Why is that? Because the neshama longs to acquire the real goods. It wants to make one with itself the real possessions that the world has to offer, which is Torah and mitzvahs and all those things that will elevate it and become part of it and become genuine kinyan and genuine possessions. And that's why you want to buy things. You can learn about it. Do you know what the soul's deepest desire is? Do you know what its single most intense, burning, uncontrollable desire is? To fuse in oneness with Hashem. The sweetness and the ecstasy of that is indescribable. And that's why you want to get married. That's the drive that men have for women and women have for men. Do you know what it teaches you? There's a desire to fuse into a oneness that is greater than either of its parts, and through that oneness to have more of a definition of who you are. Do you know what marriage can teach you? Do you know what marriage is? Where two people melt into each other and they fearlessly give themselves entirely to each other. And what they form is a oneness that far transcends either of what either of them was. And when you lose yourself like that, in this relationship, and you build something here that's indescribably different than either of you could have been, the paradox and the miracle is that instead of losing yourself, you discover who you are. You discover who you are in a more personalized, individualized sense. And what do you do with that? You give it back again into the relationship. Again, this is something that women, as it happens, know naturally, and men never learn, ever. Men are much too afraid. They don't know how to give themselves. That's not the issue. Why men and women are different, you know what that teaches you? It's another whole world. Every aspect of the world, the sweetness of what marriage is, what a relationship can be, two opposites joining, it teaches you the soul is experiencing every experience on earth. Every experience on earth. Do you know what a game teaches you? Do you know what the frivolity of a game teaches you? Playing a game. playing a game is one of the most delicious experiences imaginable. And the more trivial and meaningless, the more enjoyable it is. What on earth does that teach you? People get together and they sit down for 3 hours. Three precious hours of a lifetime that will never come again. And they go round and round and round and back. And it's delicious. Delicious. And sometimes they don't even play the game. They just sit and talk absolute nonsense. Total, absolute, meaningless garbage. For 3, 4, 5 hours at a time. Delicious. What's delicious about that? People get together and they're talking about who hit how many runs in 1935. Or... Women don't do this, by the way. Women don't do this. Women don't talk nonsense. You listen to women's conversation, you'll see it's always connected to things that are... But men can sit for... People go out to socialize. They sit around the table. Usually there's a bit of food or something else involved. And 3 hours later, they have to remember how they got to the subject. They couldn't begin to reconstruct how they got to this thing. First they talked about this and about that and how the dog died and how this happened and this, and it rambled on from one thing to another, none of it having any meaning. And it's the most delicious experience. Why? Do you know what that's teaching you? Do you know what that experience of wasting time and being involved in a trivial nothingness, you know what it teaches you? The mystical sources say it teaches you no less than what existence in the next world is. You know why? Because existence in the next world is a situation of being in a place. Do you know what a game is? A game is an experience of being in a place where there's no other place to go. Marriage also has this. Unfortunately, it's not possible to talk about it here. But a game and the laughter of a game is an experience. You know what a game is by definition? It's an activity that's justified in itself. Think about that. When you're playing a game, you don't play a game to go someplace else. A game doesn't have an object, a real game. Of course, you might play a game to do for some purpose. But a game, intrinsically, is an activity that you do. Can you feel this? A game is something that you do that is entirely justified in itself. And that's why it's delicious. You're locked into a world that has no obligation and no output. Can you feel this? Can you feel this? Are you with me? Every activity that you do in life is something that has obligation attached, right? It takes you someplace. A game is a timeout. You sit down and you do something, and that's why when it's trivial, it's pleasurable. That's specifically why when it has no output at all and no obligation at all, that's why it's pleasurable. It's an incredible... Do you know what the Torah says that Hashem does with his time? What is God doing now? It says Hashem is mishta asher ima Torah. He's playing with the Torah. He's playing with the Torah. Do you know what that means? It means he's doing an activity. He is the definition of existence, and he's engaging the substance that is the definition of endpoint. It's an experience of being in the heart of where there is to be being. That's what it means. The higher word, the higher sense of game, just then, means existence in an endpoint where there's no other place to go. Do you know what the word for a game is in Hebrew? The word is sha'ashua. Sha'ashua. It's a doubled root, sha'asha. Very unusual in Hebrew. That's very unusual. A doubled root, like gal gal, right? Sha sha. Do you know what sha means? In Hebrew, sha means to turn towards. Like velmin chaska in loy sha. He didn't turn, turning towards, right? You know what sha sha means? Sha sha, turning towards the turning towards. That's what the word actually tells you. That's what a game is. It means being in a place, right, of complete exemption. A game is a protracted experience of the moment you hit the beach. When your final school bell goes, or you finally lock the doors of the workplace and your obligation, you know the tremendous thrill it is the moment you lock those doors? It only lasts for 2 minutes. Then you start getting bored. Right? When you hit the beach, it lasts for about 5 minutes. Then you start making everyone's life around your misery because you're bored. But the point is that the first 5 minutes, you know what the pleasure is? Of no obligation. It's what we call patur. Patur means total exemption from any obligation. You know when somebody dies, we say niftar. They've become exempt from obligation. The moment of transition into the world of no obligation, that's what a game is. A game in essence is that which is played for its own sake. Can you feel that? I have a friend. My friend is a successful lawyer. What happened to him was, one morning he told me he was walking out in the morning, Sunday morning, so his kids were playing Monopoly. You're not Monopolies. He's playing Monopoly. Friday afternoon, he's getting ready for shul. He notices that his kids are playing the same game. The same game all week. So he walked over to them very paternalistically and he said to them, listen kids, you obviously don't understand how to play Monopoly. You can't keep a game going all week. Somebody has to win. Monopoly means that somebody, you buy up all the properties and eventually people go out of business and eventually they all drop out and there's one person who owns everything. That's how you play Monopoly. The kid said to him, no, Abba, you don't understand. What happens when we're playing is if one person goes out of business, we all get together and make a gemach. We make a free loan fund. We all get together. These are religious kids. We make a free loan fund, we set him up in business, and we keep playing. If your kids play Monopoly that way, what a beautiful thing. He thought he understood. They understood. There's no end point here. We join the game. We're on an end point. Somebody has to win. Who wants that? The game's over. Ah, that's not the pleasure. What a beautiful idea. What a beautiful idea. You know what you learn from playing a game? Unbelievable. Let's deal with one final experience and we'll stop with this. And if you've understood what we've said till now, then this, if this doesn't change you forever, there's no hope for you at all. Literally. There's dangerous information what I'm about to share with you. Please stay with me carefully. If every experience in the world is an analogy for something real, please stay with me. If every experience in this world is only an illusion that teaches you about reality, if this thing over here is an illusion that we call a hand, that teaches you about a real thing that the word hand really applies to, and if every human emotion and experience and phenomenon in this world is an illusion that teaches you about reality, what's a dream? What's a dream? A dream is an experience of illusion inside the illusion. What does that mean? Again, you hear me? If it gives you an example of everything real by giving you an example, it gives you an illusion inside your world of human terminology, of human experience to teach you about reality, then what's a dream? You know what a dream is? You're going through an experience, you're in total ecstasy or absolute abject terror, you're about to die, and suddenly you sit up and you're sweating and shaking and it's Baruch Hashem, it's only a dream. What's going on? You're living a world of illusion. That's what this world is. It's a world that teaches you about reality, but it's an illusion. And in the illusion, he puts you through an illusion. Why would he do that? And you don't know it's an illusion, of course. When you're dreaming, you don't know that it's a dream. If it did, you wouldn't be worried at all. You're about to die. That's what's about to happen to you. Man, you're about to be brutalized. It's unspeakable. And then you sit up a second later and you're pouring us. Why would he do that to you? Listen well. There are no exceptions in the spiritual world. There are no exceptions. Everything that happens to you is here to teach you about reality. And especially a dream. You know what a dream is supposed to teach you? Here you come to your friend and you say, you know this whole world that you see around you is just an illusion. Just an illusion, don't trust it. Looks real, but it's an illusion. It looks real, and you can touch it and think, one day, unexpectedly, no one knows when, it's going to end. You're going to go to another place. And when you get there, you'll realize that that is real. You'll realize that that's real and forever. And what you went through here is just an analogy, just an illusion. You know what the person would say to you? Do me a favor. Keep your stories to yourself. I can only judge what my senses perceive. I can only judge and relate to that which is real for me. This whole thing that looks so solid to me, but tell me it's all an illusion. What do I have to base that on? I know experience of that. You're telling me a story, but I can't accept it. And he'd be right. Except someone who's ever had a dream. Because anyone who's ever had a dream has been through the experience in their flesh of living something that was so real they were about to die. And then it changed in a second into something that showed them that it wasn't real. How can you ever after that? How can you ever after that be confident that this thing lasts forever? What a fool you are to believe that. If he never gave you an example, if he gave you a world of tangible reality and it was always reliable, and you insisted that it's going to last forever, fine, maybe. But he says to you, you want to know, go to sleep, that's all, go to sleep. What happens? You go to sleep, right? And in the sleep that you're having, you are going through something that is terrifyingly real. You're about to die, your heart is beating in panic-stricken terror. And then suddenly at some point you sit up in bed and you're shaking and sweating and say, Baruch Hashem, that was only a dream. Are you sure? Are you sure? How can you be sure? How can you be sure? A few seconds ago while you were going through it, it seemed absolutely real. That's why it was so terrifying. What makes you so confident? What makes you so confident that you're awake now? I mean, those of you who are. You see, it would be very unfair of him. It would be completely... You know why you dream? Because it would be extremely unfair of him to say to you, I want you to relate to a spiritual world and know that this thing is only temporary. And give you no example or no... How could you be expected to do that? You know what? You're right. Absolutely. I'm going to show it to you in your body, in your flesh. What more can you ask for? Go to sleep. I'll show you. You have a dream and you wake up and you've just been through the experience. And the Torah comes along and tells you that is what the world is. You have to be a very, very brazen-faced individual to deny the spiritual world and the fact that this thing ends and something else happens. Once you've been through that, and nothing unfair about it at all. He gave you the experience that you lived through. And by the way, you know that every detail of a dream teaches you this? You know that? You know that it's been shown very beautifully in sleep research that dreams that take long, long times to occur, you know, dreams that go over many weeks and months and even years, actually happen in microseconds, you know that? In milliseconds, you know that? Are you aware of that? A dream, you can demonstrate this very beautifully in research projects, that a person has a dream, when you wake them up, you ask them what happened, the dream took hours, weeks, months to occur. But you can see that the REM sleep during which the dream occurred lasted for 2 seconds. Isn't that what life is? Isn't that what life is? Where's your past now? Where's your past? Where's all the 20 years of your past? 25, 30? Nothing. It's a wisp of memory. Where is it exactly? And the older you get, the faster it goes. Isn't that exactly what a dream teaches you? Remarkable thing. And therefore, every aspect of the world is some aspect of illusion that focuses and teaches you about reality. And a dream is an illusion inside the illusion, and that teaches you about the greatest reality. That teaches you that the illusion is an illusion. Ah, what a ridiculous thing it would be to put you in an illusion and expect you to know that from the illusion you learn about reality. You have to know that this isn't real, isn't it? Good, I'll show you that too. Inside the illusion, I'll give you an illusion. I'll show you the difference between that and reality. So you've got everything you need to know. And that's the mechanism.